spectre is haunting Europe, the spectre of communism. All the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise this spectre. So begins the Communist Manifesto, written in 1848 by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Welcome to The Rest is History with me, Dominic Sambrook, well-known Marxist, and my sidekick, wishy-washy, Brixton, centrist liberal Tom Holland.
Hello, comrade.
Hello, comrade. So today we're talking about communism, the great political theory that dominated so much conversation in the late 19th and much of the 20th centuries. And actually, looking back, Tom, when we were kids, communism and capitalism are locked in this genuine competition, so it seemed, for the hearts and minds of millions of people. I mean, when you survey the world, the map, I can remember those maps from my kind of childhood, the Soviet Union and all its satellite states, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, Hungary, East Germany, and so on. You had in Africa, you had places like Angola, Ethiopia, Mozambique, you had Afghanistan, Mongolia, of course, the People's Republic of China, which is still technically communist, as are Cuba, Vietnam, and Laos. But there's been a huge falling off since then. So do you think communism is gone, or is it still with us?
I think it's such a potent idea, and it won't surprise you to know why I think it's a potent idea.
I can't wait for this.
I think it has very, very deep roots, and maybe we'll come to that. And I think that the guiding kind of ideal that it embodies, that all of humanity can be liberated and that all of humanity can share in an equal justice, is one that has an obvious appeal. And yeah. I guess that when we talk about communism, we tend to mean the specific form that it has taken in the writings of Marx, and then the way that it's evolved with Lenin and with Mao, and through the ideological war of the 20th century, as you said. But I do absolutely think that, it's, you know, China, potentially the greatest power on the face of the planet, remains a communist state. So it's ridiculous to say that, communism has gone the way of Nineveh and Tyre, simply purely on the political level. But I think it also continues to have a huge influence on the cultural level. So I would say that that probably the two most influential communist thinkers at the moment would be Antonio Gramsci, Italian, writing in the 30s, who argued that essentially kind of culture is the way for social justice to be established. And that's been hugely influential in all kinds of ways that people understand the operation of culture. Yeah. And I'd say Frantz Fanon, who, the great Martinique Francophone writer, who has essentially kind of articulated a Marxist understanding of world politics with an emphasis on how colonized societies and the global South can fight back against what he casts as oppressive imperial domination. And I would say that both of those thinkers have colossal influence. I mean, I'd go so far as to say that actually, in a way, you could say that Marxism is more influential at the moment in the United States than it is in China. Discuss.
That's an interesting argument. But they're both offshoots, aren't they, from the sort of the main trunk of communism, which we associate with Marxism. So there had been ideas about a communist society before. So Thomas More, in his book Utopia, at the beginning of the turn of the 16th century, has this vision of a society where people share property in an idealized sort of post-feudal world. And the diggers in the English Civil War.
Well,
but I mean, these are communist of a kind. They're kind of proto-Marxist ideas, you could argue, couldn't you?
Can I
do you want to bring in? Do you want to bring in your book? Do you want to do your thing?
Not,
I mean, everybody's waiting for this.
I'm not going to mention my book, but I would say that the prototype of a communist society is the early church.
I'm giving you a hard time, Tom, for no very good reason, because I actually find you very convincing on this. I genuinely think you're onto something. So go for it.
So I think the prototype is the description of the early church in the Acts of the Apostles, where it says that the apostles, selling their possessions and goods, gave to anyone as he had need. And there's an obvious echo there of Marx's famous dictum, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And essentially that posed a kind of challenge to Christians, which is this a kind of realizable ideal?
Yeah.
And it's hard to overemphasize, you know, the degree to which in the Roman world, the rich and the powerful assume themselves to be morally superior to those who are poor. And Christianity represents a really profound challenge to that assumption. And in the fifth century, you start to get the notion of a kind of class war that is motivated by Christian doctrine. And there's actually a British thinker called Pelagius who argues that humans can redeem themselves from sin through their own efforts. And this manifests itself in a kind of particularly radical Pelagian thought, with the idea that the whole of history is an expression basically of the war of the rich on the poor. And that therefore, if you get rid of the rich, then you will have paradise on earth.
Yeah.
And this gets opposed by particularly Augustine, the great father of the church, who says that humanity is fallen. We can't possibly realize heaven on earth. And so the best that can be hoped for is that the rich will continue to give to the poor. And I think that in essence, I mean, you could say that there you have communism against social democracy set yeah. up in the 5th century Roman Empire.
It's basically Karl Marx and the Cadbury's family, the sort of philanthropists
yes.
of St. Augustine is a chocolate yes. magnate.
Essentially. And Augustine's influence is obviously, he's the huge influence on the church. Pelagius gets branded a heretic. And so yeah. over the course of the church's history, there's an extreme anxiety about any suggestion that Christian teaching, particularly in the Gospels, you know, woe to the rich, the last shall be first and the first will be last, that these sayings of Christ should be put into social practice. But yeah. you do start essentially the Reformation at its radical fringes is an attempt to put that into practice.
Although, of course, you have Calvinists who think if you're rich and successful, that shows that God is smiling on you, and yes. that actually being a wealthy sort of merchant or something is a sign of God's favor, right?
Absolutely, but on the very very radical fringes, so even before the Reformation, with the Hussite Rebellion, you have this amazing communist. I think it's the first attempt to realize a communist society in European history at a place called Tabor, which is named after a mountain in the New Testament. And knights and beggars all join up and start digging this huge great city. And they're doing it against the backdrop that God is going to judge the world and that paradise will be established on the earth. I mean, and you can see that idea of trying to build a kind of a universal equality and that the New Jerusalem will be built on earth. You know, you can yeah. see that's kind of waiting. Then you've got the Anabaptists in Munster who try to do the same. You've got the diggers in the English Revolution, and all these figures are influential on Marx.
So the diggers are now in what's now a gated community, ironically, isn't it? In Weybridge,
yes,
sort of stockbroker.
Yes, that's right.
Stockbroker
yes.
belt.
Yes.
So let's fast forward a bit to the 19th century and the emergence of what people now think of as communism. And now I would argue that's and a lot of sort of Kirkian communists get very offended and very cross if you say this, but I would say it's so obviously a kind of political religion that it's barely worth arguing about. I mean, it even
Completely.
Later on has icons and banners and sacred texts and prophets and all the rest of it. But the interesting thing about Marx is that Marx is not from he's from a converted Christian background, but he's actually a Jewish heritage, isn't it? But do you
yeah.
think Marxism is basic? I mean, you obviously you do because you think everything is Christian, but you're kind of... Why
not everything. We agreed that fascism wasn't.
Any remaining skeptical listeners that Marxism is basically religious?
Well, I think that, you know, the famous phrase that you read out at the top of the show, a spectre is haunting Europe. The powers of old Europe have entered into Holy Alliance to exorcise this spectre. I mean, on the most basic level, Marx he's kind of like a Gothic writer. He's haunted by vampires and werewolves,
yeah.
and the language of Das Kapital is kind of shot through with the idea
that there
are supernatural entities.
And parasites
yes.
and all that
yes.
sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yes. But I think on the broader level, Marx takes for granted that the oppression of the poor by the rich and the powerful is wrong. But he doesn't want to say that this is a metaphysical position, because that would immediately kind of lead him wandering into theological dimensions, into the dimension of kind of the, you know, Christian thought. So he claims that it's all entirely scientific.
Well, that's the key word, isn't it? The scientific
yeah.
nature of...
And materialist,
sort of, yeah.
and historicist. So he sits in the British Library, number crunching the facts, and lots of graphs, lots of tables, supposedly proving the inevitable fact that that all of history is a class warfare, and that it is predestined that the wealthy will be overthrown, that there will, a classless paradise will be established. And it seems to me that essentially the whole pretense of Marxism to be scientific is a kind of Oedipal attempt to deny its Christian heritage, I think.
Wow, that's a big
claim. And indeed, its Jewish heritage. Because it, fascinatingly, one of Marx's ancestors was Rabbi Löw, who was a famous rabbi in 16th century Prague, who, according to legend, fashioned the golem, which was a kind of monstrous automaton, a kind of proto-Frankenstein monster, which is, in a way, a kind of sensational prefiguring of the relationship of the bourgeoisie to the proletariat. So there's all kinds of strange stuff swirling around there. And I think the idea that it's scientific is one for the birds, really. I mean, what do you think? You're a Marxist.
Well, I mean, I think it's scientific. Yeah, I think it's scientific in the sense that so many theories and ideas developed in the 19th century were thought to be scientific because it was an age obsessed with science. So it's the age of Darwinism, and it's the age of, you know, new technology and the railways and all the rest of it. And so any new theory almost by definition is going to be sort of grounded in scientific language and whatnot. And science in this case, it stands in for, I mean, Marxists often talk about being on the right side of history. So this idea of the inevitable progress of history, and it's a scientific law. I mean, science sort of stands in for God, doesn't it? In this, I think in this formula. So Walter Benjamin, the great German sort of 20th century philosopher, he compared Marxism's kind of historical materialism, as they called it. He compared it with another automaton, the Turk, which was this sort of supposed robot that was actually a bit of a con, created before, it was sort of created in, I don't know, was it the 18th, 19th century or something? And he sort of said, you know, what's hiding under the pretense of all the machinery is actually theology. And is this sort of, you know, that's Marxism's dirty little secret, that it's basically theology posing as science. And I've always sort of thought that. I mean, I can remember when I was at university meeting people who sort of said, you know, at the age of 20 with all their years of experience of the world, they would sort of say, oh, well, I'm a Marxist. And I'd often say, well, how do you know? How have you decided? How at this sort of age where we basically know nothing and we're still reading lots of stuff, how do you know that this is the blueprint that explains the world? And of course, that was a stupid question because I thought it was a political position, but it wasn't. It was a religious position. It was a statement of religious identity, I think, rather than that's obviously not always the case. There are people who are more skeptical Marxists, but it's not necessarily always, when people say they're a Marxist, it's not always a sort of cognitively carefully developed position. Often it's inherited. So I don't know if you've read David Aronovich's book about growing up in a Marxist sort of milieu. I mean, Marxists in Britain in the post-war years, where communism was a tiny thing, they had their own dentists, they had their own circles of friends, they had their own newspaper, they had their entire own view of the world. It was a closed system, not unlike a religious cult. And in many ways, I think that's what it is.
Well, Gramsci was a great admirer of the Catholic Church. And it's interesting that across particularly Latin America, but also in, you know, Catholic countries in Europe, really the kind of the battle between Roman Catholicism and communism is often a kind of, you know, it's a war between siblings, and they're both closed systems that once you buy into it, then everything makes sense.
Yes.
And I think also the other obvious parallel with Christianity is the way in which people get branded heretics, and the way in which dogma and doctrine has to be adapted to fit changing circumstance. So Marx's philosophy is clearly bred of the very distinctive circumstances of the mid-19th century. So the revolutions that are going on in 1848 in continental Europe, which end up leading to his exile to Britain, where he and Engels, who is basically kind of running factories in Manchester and going fox hunting on the weekend and things, so he has a kind of eye view of the way in which the Industrial Revolution is impacting towns like Manchester, cities like Manchester, and inflicting appalling suffering. And, you know, Marx says, you know, prophets have to have beards. He has a big beard. And there you go. No further proof needed. But it's fascinating. I mean, I think also that one of the things that you get from both Marx and Engels oddly, is almost no one writes more in, with a greater sense of awe about the achievements of the bourgeoisie than Marx. I mean, he the way in which he describes the achievements of bourgeois civilization, its restlessness, its kind of global reach, its potency, it's a stupefying portrayal of the achievements of Victorian Britain. And there is also a kind of weird sense in which, if you look at, you know, it's not just Engels with his fox hunting. Marx is kind of, you know, I mean, he's going on seaside holidays, isn't he? I think
the Isle of Wight. He's a great fan of the Isle of Wight, I think.
Yes, that was it, because he went to Ventnor, didn't he, for the last fortnight of his life and last holiday, and it rained every day. And it's kind of very Pooterish.
It's like a family holiday in the 1950s.
Yes, yes. So you've got the specifics of Marx's circumstances and Engels. And then, of course, you've got the very different circumstances of revolutionaries like Lenin, who come from a very, very different world.
That's what I wanted to move to, because, of course, the great irony with Marxism and with communism is that Marx thought exactly that. All you were saying about him and the achievements of the bourgeoisie, one reason he likes the achievements of the bourgeoisie, or is he awed by them, is because they have the seeds of their own destruction in them. So he thinks the more capitalism develops, the more sort of magnificent it is, the more quickly it will crumble.
It's the grave digger. Again, that Gothic quality.
Yeah, it is a very Gothic expression, isn't it? They're sort of digging their own graves. So he thinks the revolution is going to happen in somewhere like Britain or Germany, you know, the most advanced industrial civilizations. And actually, it happens in Russia, which is the one place that he had thought would be leading the counter-revolution. He'd sort of seen all this counter-revolutionary potential in Russia. So Russia does have two industrial cities, St. Petersburg and Moscow, but otherwise it's a huge sort of agrarian giant full of peasants. It's exactly the wrong place It's the wrong place in many ways for communism to take root. And the key figure here is Lenin, because Lenin is the person who says, well, actually what you need, you know, it's not just, you don't just need the course of history. What you need is a revolutionary vanguard, a vanguard party that will take the levers of power, stage a coup, grab power, and then push this through whether people like it or not, because it's acting in the course of history. And I think right at the beginning of right from the outset, when Marxism is put into practice, you have basically violence and dictatorship, and you couldn't have it otherwise.
I think also you have the offer of elitism. So
yeah,
the genius of Marxist Leninism is that it offers you, I mean, basically, so the Marxism will appeal to people who are very concerned with social justice, who want equality across the world, who want justice. What Lenin does is to fuse that with the sense that you need a controlling elite. On the theme of communists in London, I did a brilliant radio piece once about this room above what's now a curry shop in Whitechapel, where I think for about kind of 4 weeks, you know, there was a communist conference going on. You had Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, Rosa Luxemburg, Gorky, Zinoviev, all kind of staying in this one bedsit. I always thought it would make an amazing sitcom.
Sitcom. Very good.
Oh, Stalin! Yeah. And so I think that the brilliant irony of that is that was where the Bolsheviks, i.e. the majoritarians, the people in the majority were staying. And I think the Mensheviks were, you know, the people in the minority must have been staying in an even smaller room somewhere.
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Stalin, because Stalin kind of hangs over every discussion of communism, because... Yeah. You know, Stalin murdered millions upon millions of people. And the question with someone like Stalin, and what I find so fascinating is Stalin an aberration, which Marxists will now often claim? Oh, Stalin was somehow some imposter. He was a monster who'd somehow got his hands on the experiments and it all got out of control. Or, for example, there's the alternative view, which is, I don't know if you've read these monstrously big books by Stephen Kotkin, this American scholar who's working his way through Stalin's life. And he says, no, everyone's got Stalin wrong. Stalin wasn't a madman. Stalin wasn't even necessarily a sadist or, you know, any of these things that we imagine. He's not sort of traumatized by his childhood. He's none of those things. Stalin is actually a very good Marxist. He spent all his life immersed in Marxist ideas. He's written tons of incredibly tedious articles about aspects of Marxism in Bolshevik journals. And actually, the reason that he kills all these people is because he thinks that's the way to achieve the paradise, that he's actually a good Marxist. And that's the thing that, you know, when he makes his decisions, that's what always drives him on. And that actually the violence is inherent and the killing is inherent because that's the only way you're going to achieve this good society.
Well, I think that when you look at Stalin or Mao or indeed Hitler, you have to bear in mind that by their lights, what they're doing, they're doing for the best.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the idea of killing millions in the cause of bringing about some ideal earthly situation is so monstrous to most of us that it takes such a gear shift that I think it's difficult to do that. But I agree. I think that that Stalinism develops logically out of Leninism, which in turn is a logical attempt to adapt Marxist theory to, as you said, the kind of unexpected fact that the revolutions happened in Russia and not in Britain or Germany.
But I also think, Tom, that by its nature, it has to be violent because there's always a confiscatory element in communism. You know, some people have to be brought down. And those people are never going to say, sure, have all my furniture, you know, have my second home, please take it. You know, there's always going to be, violence is inherent in it. And violence is in the language. I mean, Lenin's language was extraordinarily violent. And Lenin, of course, famously said, you know, I used to like music and listening to nice, you know, songs and fluffy animals and nice books and stuff. But now I can't do that. I have to be harder than hard. Those things will weaken me for when I become dictator, you know, when I'll have to kill people. And he's as good as his word. And I think in that, to that, the idea of there being a separation between this sort of cuddly Marxism that Lenin supposedly incarnates and then the sort of, you know, the mass graves Marxism of Stalin, I think is a false image. Anyway, we need to take a break, Tom. Sorry. Okay. We have to take a break. The listeners are very keen to go and overthrow social conditions and collectivize agriculture. So I think we should let them do it and we'll have a cup of tea. And then you can say what you wanted to say after the break. How about that?
Are they not going? They're going to go and listen to adverts, aren't they?
Well, Marx would approve, I'm sure. All right, we'll see you after you've indulged some capitalist impulses. See you in a minute. Welcome back to The Rest is History. On Thursday, we're offering that natural companion piece to today's discussion on communism. We're talking Elizabeth I with the historian Tracy Borman. And here's an early warning for your diaries. On the evening of Wednesday, the 21st of April, we are going to do something very exciting. We're going to do our first live episode of the podcast, live on the internet. And it's going to be all about assassinations. Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, Indira Gandhi. Tom will no doubt be talking about Julius Caesar. And we'll be, not to anticipate, Caligula. Tom. No, yeah, Caligula, yeah. Of course, very good. Loads of Romans. Yeah. So we'll post a link on Twitter that week. Everybody is welcome, so you can join the show. And we'll be answering the questions live. You can throw your abuse at us then, and there's nowhere for us to hide. It will be a lot of fun for everybody. Now, Tom, I cut you off and you wanted to say something unbelievably interesting about communism.
Well, unbelievably interesting. But I'm going to combine it with the first of the many, many questions we've had. And this is from Duncan Hibbard, where he says, is communism inherently totalitarian? I'm wondering about Lenin and Stalin. Isn't Stalinism essentially economically based? So it's about trying to reconfigure the economy. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, then inevitably, in a sense, you have to kind of seize control of every possible lever. There is no space left for anyone to do anything that the government isn't controlling. And that there might be, I don't know, other, I mean, Gramsci would be maybe an alternative form of communism that puts an emphasis on control of culture rather than of the economy.
Okay. So I would say it probably is inherently totalitarian because it's not pluralist. You know, if you're a communist, you don't tolerate, you know, you can't really tolerate challenges. I think, and of course, Lenin's idea of kind of democratic centralism is that basically when the party's agreed, everybody must agree. And you can't, Marx and Lenin hated dissent or disagreement. I mean, they spent an enormous amount of time trying to crush any sort of disagreement among their own kind of little groupuscules. So I think it probably does have an inherently totalitarian bent. And I think, Tom, going back to what you're saying, Stalin thought that Russia needed rapidly to industrialize because he completely imbibed the kind of Marxist idea about the course of history that you'd become an industrial country and then you'd become, you know, a communist one. So he pushes that through, you know, and he demands total control, and particularly, and it's mainly the collectivization of agriculture. I mean, that's what kills a lot of people at the turn of the 1930s.
And he does there's no other source of revenue.
Yeah, because he needs to. Yeah, exactly. He wants to rapidly industrialize. He wants to sell grain abroad. He wants to get people into the factories. He wants to cut out. He hates the idea of, you know, private ownership among the peasants. You know, the kulaks who have built up their own little small holdings. He wants to crush them, not because he's a. I mean, his latest biographer would say not because he's a mad monster, this sort of slavering demon, but because he's a Marxist, because he thinks that's what you do to get the good society.
But he's a Marxist who has turned his back on a fairly fundamental proposition of Marx, that this is something universal. I mean, he's pushing the idea of socialism in one country.
He is, you're right. And, yes.
And so that, I mean, it's that basically that I guess once he's made that decision, once he's hitched his star to that idea, an awful lot then follows from that, because
yeah.
Immediately people in other countries are cast as enemies, and immediately the focus has to be on a kind of communist nationalism. The list of countries that you, at the beginning of the program where you listed as communist, didn't include North Korea. And I guess that, you know, I mean, it's a kind of monarchy, isn't it? Rather like St. Cuthbert.
yes.
A kind of dead body presiding over it, which shows the kind of weird ways in which communism can evolve. But I mean, it's a lot of the kind of the most monstrous crimes are where communism fuses with nationalism.
So in the Ukraine, for example, Stalin, the famine that Stalin causes there. I mean, obviously, if that had been in Russia, if it had been just outside Moscow, you're right. I think there would have, yeah, there might have been a different kind of reaction to it. I mean, our producer was hectoring me. Hectoring is probably a bit harsh, but he was giving me a hard time. He said, you know, if Stalin is just a good Marxist, how does that explain the backlash against Stalin after his death in 1953? You know, Khrushchev makes the secret speech in which he denounces Stalin's crimes. And then there's a sort of slight thawing in the Soviet Union. I mean, I think there's no doubt that Stalin became incredibly despotic, and that, you know, power corrupted, as it were. But I think, you know, a lot of those people who are, I mean, there's an interesting question about how Marxist are the leaders of the Soviet Union after the 1950s, or how much are they? I mean, in some ways, they're quite conservative. You know, they're no longer pushing sort of to create the new Jerusalem. They're defensive. They're what we have, we hold, I think. And I think.
And they're defensive, yes. And they're defensive because of the role played by the party, which becomes a kind of elite. And if you're in the party, you hold power. And if you hold power, then you want to keep hold of it.
Yeah. So I think the weird thing is, you know, these are people who in Red Square, you know, every May, they stand there on the balcony, which is on Lenin's tomb, to go back to our St. Cuthbert analogy. They're standing above the sort of mummified body of Lenin, and all these people are parading past with pictures of great icons of Karl Marx. But Marx, if he saw those men, probably wouldn't recognize them as you know, his comrades, because he's always been an outsider, a radical, a journalist tilting against convention, whereas they are the ultimate defenders of convention. You know, Brezhnev and all these sort of identikit gerontocrats in their sort of grey suits. I mean, these aren't people that Marx would sort of, I don't think he'd enjoy their company.
And I guess you can say the same about China, where it's Marxism, Leninism with Chinese characteristics, isn't it?
Yeah.
So in China, again, that question of now, what, you know, is it a communist state? I mean, clearly, formally it is. Do the Chinese part, do you know, the Communist Party in China, are they communist? Do they believe it?
I don't think they are. I mean, I think, you know, in the same way that you could possibly, well, it's an interesting one, isn't it, Tom? I mean, were people Christians? You know, were all these medieval monarchs, they believed they were Christians, I suppose. But, you know, did they, when they read about turning the other cheek and all that sort of stuff, it's harder for a rich,
some of them did.
Passing through the eye of the needle and all that sort
of
stuff.
Some of them did. Some
I mean, this is the, I think it's probably the same thing, isn't it, with the leaders of the Soviet Union, or indeed of the China, that they think they believe it, but they don't live it, maybe is a distinction. I don't know. We should move on to another question. We should move on to Beatrice Mouse. Now, Beatrice Mouse says, for those who say it hasn't been tried properly, isn't its failure baked in? Properly ends up with economic failure and tyranny. I mean, this is the stuff of a thousand social media arguments. Has it been tried properly or not? Do you think, Tom, it's been tried properly? Do you think it's been given a fair crack of the whip?
Well, I think to go back to the key perspective of Marx, it's about justice and it's about liberating people to fulfill their potential. And if you think of it in those terms, rather than in the supposed ironclad economic laws that will make it happen and the whole kind of ideological apparatus that has been built up around it, I think that that ideal absolutely preserves its power. And to go back to what I was saying at the beginning of the program, I think that a lot of what is agitating people in the West at the moment is kind of recognizably bred of that matrix, I think.
So that's a slightly evasive answer. You haven't said whether you think it has or hasn't been tried properly.
I think the assumption is because we've had communist states,
we think that
there is such a thing as communism.
Yeah.
But I think that if you think of it, again, a bit more like Christianity or something like that, as an ongoing
way of living,
an approach, an ideal, an attempt to shape your life by certain ideals, then I think that the idea of, I know that of course Marx is talking about the fact that there will ultimately be a class of society. So that is baked into his perspective. But it's very telling, I think, that in his writings, he barely talks about it. And even Lenin, I mean, he's obsessed with the dictatorship of the proletariat, and you need the dictatorship of the proletariat to usher in what will ultimately be the classless state. It's just that it never arrives. So I guess to the degree that the New Jerusalem will never be built on earth, the classless society will never arrive. Failure is inevitable because it's not going to happen because this is a theological myth.
Yeah.
But I think that as a way of governing your life, clearly it provides meaning for people across the face of the planet, and it continues to convulse and agitate the way that certainly British society, American society, European society is operating at the moment. I think that if you think of communism as a way of living rather than an inevitable endpoint, I think that would be my take.
See, what I would say, Tom, is even if you think of it as a way of living, if you look at all the regimes that proclaim themselves communist, and there were quite a lot. I mean, we're talking about, dozens. There are lots of examples of people where they've taught capital, Das Kapital in schools, where they've had all the banners, where they've had the pictures of Marx, where, academies have been devoted to this stuff, where they really thought they were following it. And in every one, there's been, repression, violence.
Yeah.
I mean, that there's a point at which you sort of say, well, maybe this isn't a coincidence. Maybe this is kind of baked into the project from the very outset. I think because of its anti-pluralist nature, because if you claim to have a monopoly on truth, and if you claim we are carrying out the will of history, as all these regimes did, particularly, from 1945 onwards, then you're always going to get into trouble because any form of challenge is illegitimate.
Yeah, and I think the idea that there are ironclad economic rules that have to be followed, even when they don't actually work, is a huge part of the problem. But on the broadest level, I think it is impossible to build Jerusalem on earth. I think Augustine is right. I think that, we are fallen, however you want to put it. Humans are not capable of living like that. And it's true, it's true of communists, it's true of Christians, it's true of Muslims. Wherever you try and build the ideal state without acknowledging the fact that humans are humans and things are going to go wrong, you end up with disaster.
Have you ever seen this stuff or read this stuff about Boris Yeltsin going to America? So Boris Yeltsin, I think he's the, what is he then? Is he the, he's a big figure, I think, in he's just been kicked out of the Politburo, but he's still big in the Russian parliament or he's a big in Moscow party boss or something.
Is he mayor, mayor of Moscow?
Exactly. Mayor of Moscow, I think he is. He goes off to visit NASA near Houston. And on the way, he says, I actually want to see what America is really like away from all the handlers. And he stops in a place called Clear Lake and he goes to a supermarket called Randall's. And there's pictures of him in this supermarket inspecting the freezer cabinets and stuff. And it's just a kind of piddling little supermarket. And his ashen-faced. He is horrified. And he gets in his car afterwards, and all the people, his aides said, you know, he didn't speak for kind of 40 minutes or something. And he was so distressed. And he said, how we have failed, you know, the Russian people. It's just abominable that Americans are living like this. And, you know, the supermarkets in Russia have kind of a dead dog in them or something. And that's it. And he's just, and it's astounding the extent to which even the kind of elite were kind of living in a complete fantasy world. And the spectacle of what capitalism was actually really like was just this dreadful shock when Yeltsin realized.
Is it Reaganite propaganda that Gorbachev basically realized the game was up when he went to California and flew in a helicopter over LA and looked down at all the swimming pools or something?
I don't know. I don't know. I think certainly one of Gorbachev's key aides was a man called Alexander Yakovlev. He went to Canada and he became friends with Trudeau. And he was devastated by what he saw in Canada. You know, it was just like to see how ordinary people lived was because, of course, people were told that only the elite live like this. That, you know, in Russia, you believed that the kind of Western elite were selling a lie and that everybody was actually really downtrodden and miserable. And to get there, I think for a lot, and the same with Oleg Gordievsky, actually, who we talked about with Ben McIntyre, the defector. He too, you know, he was in Copenhagen. And again, he was, you know, standing there thinking, we are the baddies.
Okay. But I think that's been reconfigured since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union. Because that spectacle of wealth, of course, was precisely what shocked Marx. And what you get in Capital, away from all the graphs and the figures, is this sense of kind of molten anger at the way in which the prosperity of the bourgeoisie depends upon, you know, children starving and people being evicted from their homes. And I think more particularly, people in distant colonies, you know, being worked to death so that the bourgeoisie can have sugar with their tea. And I think that actually today, the spectacle of Western wealth operates for many people in a similar way. And I think that's a huge dynamic in the kind of understanding of global relations. The idea that Western wealth has been built on systematic exploitation. And so Lenin's idea that imperialism is kind of the last, you know, the ultimate manifestation of bourgeois civilization, I think that still has an afterlife in contemporary culture.
It definitely does. And it's very popular. The problem, though, that you have, if you're going to take that line, I think, is how do you explain then, you know, the massive rise in life expectancy and living standards in places like in Africa and in Asia. So these are,
well, particularly Asia,
but also in Africa too. I mean, the rise in life expectancy, for example, you know, these are never have so, you know, in many ways, of course, because there are more people, there are more poor people than ever, but relatively speaking, the human race now lives longer. We live longer, much more comfortable, much more prosperous lives, insulated from the fear of early death or disease than any generation before us. I mean, that's come at a punishing environmental cost, as we all know. But the problem is the exploitation of the poor argument. I mean, not everything is based on sweatshops. Anyway, we need to do some questions, Tom.
Yes.
Our listeners, so if there are any listeners still left, they're probably outraged. Go on, ask a question.
Here's one from Chet Archbold, who always comes up with good questions. Was the development of some sort of communist ideology inevitable in Europe? There were some communist-like movements before Marx, but if Marx had not lived, would something quite like Marxism have emerged? And that's great, isn't it? Because an awful lot of Marx is that certain things are inevitable. And that, you know, someone like Marx is just epiphenomenal. He's just a bubble of froth on a heaving ocean.
This is a bit like the question I think we've debated before. Would the Beatles have, you know, if John and Paul had never met, would there still have been the Beatles? There would still have been Marxism. Yeah, clearly. Because Marx was building on Saint-Simon and Fourier and Robert Owen, and there were loads Proudhon of thinkers of this kind. Yeah. Proudhon, exactly. So there was Bakunin, and there were other people who could have been sort of maybe would have loomed larger than Marx did. I mean, Marx was in many ways a genius. I don't think there can be any doubt of that. You know, a man of enormous intellectual capability, which is why he became such a big figure. And he's a great self-promoter and a great propagandist as well. And the Communist Manifesto is a great read. But there would have been, don't you think there would have been some form of...
Yeah, I do. I think, however, and again, not to sound like go on my King Charles's head, I think that the hostility to religion might have been less, because there were many communist thinkers who were very keen on all the kind of cloudy, fluffy, heavenly stuff, as Marx liked to dismiss it. So I think that's maybe the key thing that Marx brought to the party.
The producer is gagging for us to do Rick Hunter's question. I God knows why, but I mean, maybe he is Rick Hunter, or maybe Rick Hunter has something on him. So Rick Hunter, no offense, Rick. Rick Hunter says, if the Mensheviks had launched the Russian Revolution instead of the Bolsheviks, how would things have played out? Was that ever a real possibility? I would say no. It probably wasn't a real. Well, it would have been a completely different revolution. Tom, what do you think?
Well, I think that, the difference between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks is essentially how brutal are you willing to be, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's basically how moderates versus radicals to some extent.
So I think yes. So I think that a bunch of kind of, centrist dads were never going to.
That's a big. Yeah, I don't think the Mensheviks
were never going to kick off the Russian Revolution.
The Russian Revolution.
I mean, it's the brutality. You said the violence is baked in.
And yet the irony, right, the ambiguity is the Bolsheviks succeed because the one thing they offer is peace. Everybody else pretty much is arguing for Russia to carry on in the First World War in the summer of 1917. And the Bolsheviks make progress, particularly among the army, because they're the ones who are saying, no, we'll have peace with Germany. We'll stop fighting straight away. And all their rivals are sort of shilly-shallying and saying, well, we're still committed to the Allies. So the Bolsheviks win by saying peace, but also they're prepared to be more extreme. They're always prepared to go further than anybody else. And so, of course, if anybody else had been, if Kerensky had stayed in power, then yes, the history of the 20th century would look, it would look very different, I think.
Similar dialectic going on with Trotsky and Stalin. And Stalin ultimately wins out again because he essentially, weirdly, offers, peace and stability, whereas Trotsky's all about permanent revolution.
Well, Trotsky's a loose cannon, isn't he? He's a complete loose cannon. And Stalin is the secretary. He is the boring guy in the meetings. He's got done all the paperwork.
I love the idea that that both Lenin and Stalin are the kind of safe, stable Liz J, great question here. Would a non-communist Russia have been able to resist and ultimately defeat Nazi Germany, or was it the unique nature of being a communist state that allowed it to fight the war with such brutal force and disregard for human life? That's a great question. And you've just written a review of a book on Stalin's war, haven't you?
I have, yeah. A very extraordinary book, actually, by a man called Sean McMeekin. Now, McMeekin, he has this great idea, this brilliant central idea of, let's... Instead of thinking about the war just about Hitler, we should think about it through Stalin is the key to the war, not Hitler. So, Stalin, look at it through Russia's point of view. It's Russia that Russia also invades Poland. Russia swallows up the Baltic states. Japan is largely motivated by fear of Russia. So Russia allows you to tie together sort of the East and Western theatres, the sort of Pacific and the European theatres of the war. But he also has this extraordinary argument, which slightly to me, fatally undermines his book, which is that the Allies should have attacked Stalin as well as Hitler. So we should have, having declared war on Hitler about Poland, we should then have declared war on Stalin when Stalin went into Finland. We should have fought in defense of Finland. He thinks that Britain and France, if we'd fought Stalin in Finland, that Roosevelt would have joined in, which I don't think he would, and that Mussolini would have joined in on our side as well. So that would be a very different Second World War. Anyway,
you're starting me off there. That was entirely my fault. I sent
it. You took me down the wrong course. Would a non-communist Russia? Maybe not, actually. I mean, the nature of communism meant that you could discipline and control millions of people. And as you say, it's the idea of sacrificing people in the name of the greater good. That sort of came naturally to Stalin's commanders. And the sort of no step back rule that the Soviet commissars are always sort of drumming into their officers. I mean, that feels very Stalinist. And military historians, people like Max Hastings, will say, the Russians were prepared to do whatever it took and pay any price. When British generals or American generals were a bit weedy about sacrificing their men, Stalin's generals knew that basically if they didn't sacrifice their men, they'd be shot themselves. So they were very effective in that sense.
Wasn't the same thing going on with Napoleon's invasion of Russia, though?
That's the argument. And then, of course, in the First World War, the Tsarist officers treated their men like absolute.
Yeah.
They treated them a business.
Cannon fodder. Also, it's when the Nazis invade that Stalin slightly resurrects some of the old traditions of Russia.
Orthodoxy.
So he sends an icon up in a plane that flies around the the city limits of Moscow.
So that's Stalin. Stalin's a much underestimated politician because he's much more flexible than, let's say, Hitler is. He's cannier than Hitler. And I think you're right about there's always this. People often forget about Russia that as recently as the sort of mid to late 19th century, about 40 million Russians had been serfs. They're basically made slaves. So the sort of violence and inequality was baked into Russia, Stalinism or no Stalinism. Okay.
I think we've got time for one more question.
Golly. Do you want to do the space question?
Yes. So this is Richard Goldstein, and he asks, yeah. If technology continues to rapidly improve, isn't a communistic system inevitable for Earthlings in 1,000 years, if not 100 years? When there is no barrier to material well-being, wouldn't competition-dependent livelihoods become obsolete? There's a lot of communism in science fiction.
I love the fact that Richard Goldstein may not himself be human when he talks about Earthlings. Yeah, there is. You're right. And there is a communist group called the Positists. The Positists, Dennis Healy complained about in his memoirs that he was being heckled. The Positists were supporting Tony Benn in the Labour deputy leadership election of 1981. The Positists believe that because communism is the future, and because communism, because it's the future and it's historically inevitable, communism, you know, is identified with technological modernity. The Positists believe that if there were any other civilizations in the universe that were more advanced than us, they would by definition have to be communist. So they thought the revolution would probably be brought, and they still do think the revolution will probably be brought to Earth by people on flying saucers who will impress us with their communism and then will convert us. We'll all become communists. I don't find that very plausible. And I don't find Richard Goldstein's argument very, I don't think it will become inevitable, actually. I think it goes against human nature.
You brought up Tony Benn.
Yeah.
Who
great favorite
I learned
of mine, as you know.
From your book, got stung on the penis by a wasp.
In the bath?
I think when he was gardening, wasn't it? But a kind of interesting parallel to Marx, who had a huge boil on his penis and wrote to Engels about it. So there you go.
Wow.
Great heroes.
This is what happens.
Great heroes of socialism.
Left wing of the spectrum, isn't it? When you get into that world, boils follow.
Brilliant. Well, I think the grave digger of our podcast has... time is the grave digger of our podcast.
I think this sort of highbrow analysis is precisely what is needed to close the conversation about Marxism forever. Well, time has been largely called on communism. Internationally, it's been called on us too today. A reminder that on Thursday, we're talking about Elizabeth I with Tracy Borman. So you can't ever accuse us of having too narrow a field of interest on this podcast. Anyway, thank you for listening. Enjoy the revolution and see you soon.
Bye.